From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Actresses and moviegoers share a great frustration, the shortage of good roles for women. On today's Fresh Air, we take hope and talk with two terrific actresses who've carved out interesting and unusual careers in spite of the obstacles. Frances McDormand stars in Fargo as a pregnant police chief in rural Minnesota, investigating her first homicide. McDormand also co-starred in Raising Arizona, Mississippi Burning, and Shortcuts. Lily Taylor stars as the disturbed radical feminist Valerie Solanas in the new movie I Shot Andy Warhol. Taylor got her start in the same film that Julia Roberts did, Mystic Pizza, and headed in a completely different direction. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Maryland police have ruled out foul play in the death of former CIA Director William Colby. Searchers found his body this morning in the Wicomico River in southern Maryland. He disappeared more than a week ago while canoeing. A spokesman for the State Natural Resources Division says Colby was probably alive when he fell into the water, then got hypothermia and drowned. Colby was 76. He served as CIA chief under Presidents Nixon and Ford. Residents in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana are bracing for more bad weather. They were hit over the weekend by heavy thunderstorms and flooding. Three people died in the storms. Lorna Jordan, a member station WVXU, reports from Cincinnati.
Tornadoes touched down in half a dozen Midwestern states over the weekend, leaving thousands without power, destroying a number of mobile homes and injuring people. One county in central Kentucky is under a state of emergency after high winds hit over the weekend. National Guard troops have been asked to help clean up and patrol the area. The National Weather Service will determine today if the storm was a tornado. High winds, hail, and lightning were not the only problems. Flood warnings are posted for some rivers in south-central Ohio. At least 6 inches of rain fell in some parts of the region over the weekend. More rain is in the forecast for today. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cincinnati.
New Mexico firefighters are struggling to control a blaze that's raging through the northern part of the state. Several homes have been destroyed and some 2,000 people have been evacuated. No one's been hurt. The fire started yesterday apparently from burning trash and charred 3,000 acres by nightfall. High winds are hampering firefighters' work. About 400 Arizona firefighters are working to contain a blaze that briefly forced the evacuation of a dozen homes outside Flagstaff. That blaze was started by youngsters who were playing with matches. A new study is raising concern that women on the contraceptives Norplant or Depo-Provera could be more at risk for getting the virus that causes AIDS. NPR's Vicky Quay reports.
Scientists have wondered if a synthetic hormone in certain contraceptives can trigger a change in the lining of a woman's vagina, which could make her more susceptible to HIV. So they conducted an experiment with 28 monkeys. 18 of the animals were treated with progesterone. Then all of the monkeys were exposed to a virus similar to the one that causes AIDS. 14 of the 18 monkeys that were treated contracted the virus, whereas only one of the monkeys that wasn't treated became infected. But the researchers say it's too early to know whether the results will hold true for humans. The animals were given high dosages of progesterone. Women on Norplant and Depo-Provera received much lower levels. I'm Vicky Quay in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow has fallen more than 39 points to 5,439 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq is down more than 5 points at 1179. This is NPR. The Pulitzer Prize-winning rock musical Rent has received 10 Tony nominations, more than any other show. Rent is up for Best Musical, along with the song Bringin' to Noise, Bringin' to Funk. Other Best Musical nominees are Chronicle of a Death Foretold and Swinging on a Star. Nominees for Best Play in the Tony Awards are Buried Child, Master Class, Racing Demon, and Seven Guitars. Former South Korean President Chun Doo-hwan, who's being tried for ordering the violent crackdown on pro-democracy protesters in 1980, denied that he sent troops to put down the demonstrations. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
Chun faces treason for ordering a violent end to a 9-day rebellion against martial law in the southern city of Gwangju 16 years ago. The former president told a 3-judge panel today that he believed the protests could not be tolerated for the sake of the country's security. In a situation of intense confrontation between North and South Korea, Chun testified the crackdown was inevitable. When asked whether he attended a critical meeting in which the military suppression was discussed, Chun denied that he was present. That was on a Sunday, he said. I received information about what happened at Gwangju only the next day. Chun is on trial with his classmate, No Tae-woo, who succeeded Chun in office. The two men also face charges of corruption stemming from political slush funds estimated to be worth millions of dollars. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Fighting has resumed in Monrovia, Liberia, after a weekend of brutal violence. Thugs set many buildings on fire and forced thousands of people to run from their homes. The capital's military barracks, which has been a focal point for gunfire, has been struck by rocket-propelled grenades. Hundreds of militiamen on all sides of the conflict are pouring into the capital, increasing the firepower. Peace talks, led by international mediators, are supposed to start Wednesday. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Frances McDormand, is the star of the new film Fargo, an offbeat crime drama laced with black humor. When the movie opens, a car salesman who's deep in debt cooks up a money-making scam. He's going to hire people to kidnap his wife, collect the ransom money from her wealthy father, then split the ransom with the kidnappers. But of course, the plan blows up in his face, starting with a triple homicide. Frances McDormand plays Marge Gunderson, the very pregnant chief of police in the rural Minnesota town of Brainerd. She never leaves her house without a full breakfast prepared by her husband, Norm. This is her first homicide investigation. Here she is with her deputy at the crime scene examining the victims.
Here's the second one. It's in the head and the hand there. I guess that's a defensive wound.
Oh, yeah?
Where's the state trooper?
Back there, good piece, in the ditch next to his prowler.
Okay. So we got a trooper pull someone over. We got a shooting. These folks drive by. There's a high-speed pursuit. Ends here, and then this execution-type deal.
Yeah.
I'd be very surprised if our suspect was from Brainerd.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, from his footprint, he looks like a big fella.
You see something down there, Chief?
No, I just think I'm gonna barf.
Jeez. You okay, Margie?
Yeah, I'm fine. It's just morning sickness. Well, that passed.
Yeah?
Yeah, now I'm hungry again.
Fargo was co-written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, who gave McDormand her first film role in their first film, Blood Simple. She was also in their film, Raising Arizona. McDormand and Joel Coen are now married. McDormand's other movies include Mississippi Burning, Dark Man, and Shortcuts. She's currently featured in Primal Fear. I asked her about her first impressions of the character she plays in Fargo.
I've known Joel and Ethan for 13 years. I met them 13 years ago, doing Blood Simple, and have known them since then, and in fact have known Joel intimately since then as my husband. So when I first read the script, it was a long pause, and why me? Why am I Marge? I wasn't exactly sure. But when we started working on it, the crew was so enamored of Carl and Grimsrud, you know, the two bad guys, that I started thinking maybe Marge is the bad guy and they're the good guys. I wasn't really sure. But I think what's really great, what I always loved about Marge, is that she does lead a really simple life and has a very cozy domestic situation and, you know, a good job in a small town police department. But what's really great about her is that she is so competent in her job.
Yeah.
And the minute she gets to the crime scene, it becomes evident that she's not everything she appears to be. She's a lot more.
She's a lot more interesting than you think she's going to be.
Yeah, I, in fact, find just that whole opening where she's in bed with Norm and then they have breakfast. There's something really fascinating about their relationship, even though on the surface it seems so kind of mundane and banal.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot going on there and has been for years.
Now, I read that you have a sister who's a chaplain at a women's maximum security prison.
Actually, a men's maximum security prison.
Wow.
Yeah. I wasn't thinking about Dorothy when I was, you know, working on Marge. It was after the movie was done and I saw it and I turned to Joel and said, ooh, there's a little bit of Dorothy in Marge, isn't there? And he said, yeah, I hadn't thought about it either, but there is. And it's something about her approach to, my sister's very old-fashioned in a way in her perspective on the world. It's, you know, obviously in her job working at a maximum security prison, she can't be naive and she can't be innocent to what's going on around her. But she has a lot of faith in human goodness, and I think that that's part of Marge.
The character that you play, Marge Gunderson, the chief of police, is hardly a glamour role. She's pregnant, very pregnant, throughout the film and wearing a big parka most of the time. Was that ever an issue for you that, I mean, not only wasn't this a glamour role, but it was a role where you were going to be real padded?
No. Well, I've never really played a glamour role. I mean, the only attempt I've ever made, I don't think I was very successful at, did a movie called Dark Man where I played, you know, the girlfriend. And that was the only time I ever really got to pay attention to, you know, what I wore and what I looked like. And I, in fact, found it very boring. Because that's really all I had to do. I mean, it's not all I had to do, obviously. I was playing a character in the movie. But what was great about Marge, it was wonderfully liberating not having. And in fact, I think I really like the way Marge looks. I mean, just vanity-wise, I feel like she looked good. Mm-hmm. I mean, I liked the way I looked. And I think that, but there was something really liberating about the costume and the padding, and I was wearing a wig and the accent. It was kind of like really similar to the clown work. And I don't mean, you know, slapstick, fall down, little cars and, you know, horns type clowning. But the clown work that I learned in drama school where we would put on kind of half masks and stand in front of a mirror and let the mask transform our face and then transform our body, then our movement, and then our voice. Every morning that I put on the pregnancy pad, the costume, the wig, started working with the accent, it was a total transformation into someone else, which is very hard to do on film as opposed to theater.
Now, you've never been pregnant, right?
No, I haven't. I am a mother. We adopted our son Pedro 11 months ago. So I've been expectant, but never pregnant.
So did you feel like you should talk to mothers about what the experience of carrying was like?
No, you know, because I had played a pregnant character before or earlier in my professional life, Stella in Streetcar Named Desire. And I had that memory of, you know, just theatrically working with it. And also there was something about Marge that I think, in fact, Norm was much more pregnant than Marge was in a way. It was important for me that it was just a fact of Marge's life. And I think it was important for Joel and Ethan that it was more a visual aspect of the character than something that was referred to. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of dramaturgically, there was this idea that there was the pregnancy of the future involved in Norm and Marge's life, that they were kind of the caretakers of the future in amongst all the craziness and the tragedy and the bizarre aspects of the movie. Marge and Norm have hope of the future. But I also think it was just a visual thing about Marge. She was this large, solid piece of brown in the middle of the white landscape.
Now, the Minnesota accents have proved to be somewhat controversial. I've read that there are some people in Minnesota who are offended at the broadness of the accents. Were you already familiar with that accent before you did the role?
No, I'd never worked on a Minnesotan accent before. Mm-hmm. Joel and Ethan are from Minnesota, but don't really have one. They've been away for about 20 years, so mm-hmm. whatever they had, they've lost. Sometimes in vowel sounds you hear it, but not in the cadence, in the music of it. But they'd written it into the script. It was scored. The script was scored with the accent. Every ya and you betcha and you oh geez was right there in the script. So it wasn't like it wasn't evident from the beginning that was necessary to create the music, you know, to score the script. But I'm from the Midwest, and though the vowel sounds in a Minnesotan accent are really based in the Scandinavian origin of the, you know, the group of people in Minnesota and Wisconsin, in that area, there was a really big Scandinavian immigration. So the vowel sounds and the music are originally from there, but it's also a lot about the attitude, which I've always found as an actor working on a dialect is just as important as the technical aspects of a dialect. And I spoke with one of the actresses that played, Hooker number one. She didn't have a name. Hooker number one, Larissa, who played the smaller of the two hookers. And she was born and raised in Minneapolis. And she talked about Minnesota nice.
Minnesota nice?
Minnesota nice is the armor there. It's keeping a smile on your face to get you through everything that you need to get through in life until absolutely necessary that you change that into something else. And what it really helped with Marge was that she always had a smile on her face, because just technically it helped me get the accent. Mm-hmm. As long as I kept a smile on my face, it was a little flatter, it was a little rounder, it was a little softer, it was a little slower. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you about the food in Fargo. The food that Marge mm-hmm. eats is mm-hmm. these huge platters piled high with like beef and potatoes and steam plate vegetables. And it's
chicken
almost
and dumplings.
Yeah, okay. It's almost as if like the special effects department prepared the platters of food for you.
That was real food, that smorgasbord. I'll tell you, it was actually a really great smorgasbord. It's just hard eating that food for 10 hours, you know. And of course, Joel and Ethan wanted us to really be shoveling it in, so we were shoveling it in. And what's always weird about when you're eating in a scene, especially in a movie, is that you know, the audience sees you do it through one scene, but we were doing it literally for 10 hours. And in the middle of that, of course, everyone breaks for lunch, and you're the last person that wants to eat lunch. But what I love about that scene is that it obviously it's not expository, it doesn't tell anything about it, doesn't further the plot in any way, but it's really great character behavior. You know that Marge and Norm do this at least 3 times a week, and it's something that's very specific to my background, actually. I know whenever I go home to visit my parents, they've found a new smorgasbord restaurant or an all-you-can-eat place. You put down your $12.95, you eat your money's worth, you stay there till you eat your money's worth. And my father's always been very satisfied with restaurants of that kind. I think it's a very American tradition, you know, you get
Absolutely.
Your money's worth.
Absolutely.
It's the bounty. They call it the groaning board where my parents live.
My guest is Frances McDormand, star of the new film Fargo. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Frances McDormand, star of Fargo, which was co-written and co-directed by her husband and brother-in-law, Joel and Ethan Coen. When your husband presented you with the part of Marge in Fargo, did you say to yourself, uh-oh, what if I don't like it?
No, you know, I never even considered that, because it wouldn't have mattered. There's something about, you know, I learned about movies from Joel and Ethan. I mean, the first film I ever did was Blood Simple. Was their first film. Mm-hmm. I'd never done any work behind the camera before that. And besides that, the set of Blood Simple was really, really special. And I didn't learn that until later after being on other sets. Their sets are very collaborative. They're very tension-free. They're very conducive to making a good movie and making friends with people that are working on it. So after working, I've worked with a lot of really great directors and have been in really great situations, but I still find their sets the most fun to work on and the most collaborative. So irregardless of the fact that I know them and live with one of them. So it wouldn't have mattered what it was. I was just really excited to go back to work with them. And I kind of come to a point in my professional life where I knew that if I got to work with Joel and Ethan maybe once every 5 years for the rest of my professional life, I'd be very happy.
If this isn't too personal, did you and Joel Cohen fall in love while making Blood Simple?
I think Joel and I, it wasn't really until about 6 months after we worked on Blood Simple that we realized we were doing more than hanging out and that it was going to take a little longer to figure out what it was. And then about 10 years later, we realized that we'd lived together for 10 years, which was pretty exciting for both of us, pretty amazing. So I think, yeah, I'm sure we fell in love. At the time, it was much more about, it was a really exciting. I think both of us were starting out doing what we wanted to do for the rest of our lives, which was a really exciting time. And I think we both had the same attitude about what we wanted to do for the rest of our lives. And so I think that it was much more about a combination of falling in love in a romantic sense, but also finding someone whose attitude you respected about their professional life. I mean, it was a lot of things. It was really meeting some, you know, it was much more the beginnings of a mature relationship than either of us had ever been in before.
Frances McDormand is my guest, and she's starring in the film Fargo. How did you first get bit by the acting bug?
Mrs. Zelli, my English teacher in ninth grade, we were reading Shakespeare, and she had us read some of the scenes out loud in class. And then at the time, we were reading Macbeth. And we put together some scenes from Macbeth and did them for our parents and friends after school one day. And I did the sleepwalking scene, Lady Macbeth's sleepwalking scene, at the age of 14, which I now think is quite presumptuous. But I would get lost in reading. Reading was my escape, and I read voraciously from the moment I could, you know, I could have a library card. And I think in retrospect, I know now that it wasn't just standing up in front of people and feeling that kind of power and that kind of excitement. It was also the idea of realizing that this very private thing that I did, this reading and this relationship I had with literature, could in fact be a public relationship with a group of people. And that's when it started.
Mm-hmm. I'm always interested in hearing actresses talk about roles for women. What have your experiences been? Do you feel satisfied that there have been good, interesting roles available for you? Or do you feel that there really is trouble with the availability of roles for women, of good roles, roles that aren't just glamour roles?
Yeah, there are not enough stories. Just basically, there are not enough stories being told. I mean, there are great stories specifically about women, but also there are just better stories about people in general than are being told in movies. I feel really lucky in that I've been able to make my own personal statement in the roles that I've played. And it has not always been the most sought after roles. I mean, I've played a lot of very small supporting roles in films, in television, on stage, often female roles in all of those are supporting roles. I mean, it's just kind of, you know, the nature of the stories that are being told. But I feel like even in those smaller supporting roles, I've been able to find the different story to tell. And recently, this was really wonderful. Recently, a friend called me. He was doing a script, really wonderful script called Hidden in America. And there, he called me and asked me if I would come for a short amount of time to play a role in the script, which was a mother. A really wonderful role, but not something that captured my imagination at the time. And I said to him that I really wasn't interested in doing that, but what I really liked in the script was Gus, the car mechanic. I said, who's playing that part? And he told me, and I said, well, tell that actor that he's got some competition because I really like that part. So I got a call 2 days later. The director talked to the actor who was playing Gus, car mechanic, who was a friend of his, told him that I was interested in the part, and the actor said, well, she's much better for the role. I think you should cast her. So I got to go play Gus, the car mechanic. She was Gus, the car mechanic. It was wonderful. Didn't have to change one line of the script. Didn't have to play her in any more masculine way than, you know, a man would have had to play a female role in a feminine way. That happened to be her job.
When is the movie opening?
It's a movie for Showtime, actually, and I'm not sure when it'll be on.
Okay. And you're opening in a John Sayles movie?
Yeah, it's really good. Lone Star.
And when is that coming out?
I believe it's in June.
And you're also now in Primal Fear.
Primal Fear, which is really good. And a low-budget independent called Palookaville by first-time director Alan Taylor. It's a really good movie. What else? That's it, I think.
So this is actually a very good time for you in terms of your career.
Oh, life in general.
Right, I mean, life in general, sure.
It's like,
adopted son, lots of movies. Yeah,
he's
good.
Talking, he's starting his first words.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a little terrifying. You know, I was watching a tape of a short movie that I did last year with a friend and on TV, and Pedro pointed to the TV and went, Mama. But oh my goodness, here we go. This is the beginning. Now he's going to not understand why everybody he knows isn't on TV. But yeah, it's really exciting. In the last 2 years, what's really wonderful I'm finding in my professional life now is that a lot of people who are coming out of film school and starting their professional lives as directors and producers in film and in the theater as well know my work. They've seen my work. They've seen a lot of my work. I've been working for 15 years. And they think of me, I'm one of the actors that they think of. When they need, you know, a 38-year-old woman, a woman in her late 30s, early 40s, they go, yeah, that woman from Blood Simple. Let's get her.
Frances McDormand, great to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Frances McDormand stars in the new film Fargo. You can also see her in Primal Fear. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Harmony Books, publisher of Deepak Chopra's The Way of the Wizard, 20 Ways for Living a Magical Life. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you. Coming up, I Shot Andy Warhol. We talk with Lily Taylor about her starring role in the new film as Valerie Solanas, the disturbed radical feminist who nearly killed Andy Warhol. Taylor's other films include Mystic Pizza, Say Anything, and Household Saints.
And cure his heart. Downy sins of streetlight fancies chase the costumes she shall wear. Adorn imperious, Severin, Severin awaits you there.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lily Taylor, is getting rave reviews in her new film, I Shot Andy Warhol. She plays Valerie Solanas, the deranged radical feminist who shot Warhol three times in 1968 at his loft, which was known as the Factory. She told the cops that Warhol had too much control over her life. She'd been trying to convince Warhol to stage her play. He remained uninterested, although he did cast her in one of his films. Solanas was driven and smart, but her ideas were perverted by her own mental illness. She believed in the natural superiority of women over men, which she wrote about in her book The Scum Manifesto, which called for killing most men. She wrote it 6 months before she shot Warhol. He survived, but never fully recovered. In this scene, Solanas is at a party at Warhol's factory. Warhol and Solanas are sitting uncomfortably together at opposite ends of a couch. He's just taken out his portable tape recorder.
Would you say something, Singer?
What?
Yeah, I'm, you know, I have, like an hour's worth on tape here, you know, and I was just wondering, maybe you could just do a, you know, like a monologue for me.
No, I mean, I can't just monologue like that. I mean, I need a stimulating person like yourself, you know, to talk to. I can just do it on my own.
Oh, come on, Valerie. Say something dirty. That's so easy for you. Let's talk about sex. Sex is really nothing, isn't it?
I could read you something from my latest masterpiece, Scum Manifesto.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Sex is the refuge of the mindless. Sex is not part of a relationship. On the contrary, it is a solitary experience, non-creative, a gross waste of time.
Oh, so true.
Want to read more?
Yeah.
The female can easily, far more easily than she may think, condition away her sex drive. The male, who digs the female sexually.
Lily Taylor is now identified with independent films, but she got her start in a film that developed into a box office hit, Mystic Pizza. Her films include Dogfight, Say Anything, Household Saints, The Addiction, and Ready to Wear. I asked her what she knew about Valerie Solanas before taking the part.
I had picked up the manifesto at the City Lights bookstore in San Francisco in 1991. I saw a picture of Valerie, and it caught my eye because it was this picture of this woman who had no apology on her face. And then I looked through it, and I was floored even more. I'd never read anything like that before. And I bought it and read it and put it on my shelf and sort of kept it in the back of my mind. And then Mary Harron approached me in 1993 with a treatment of I Shot Andy Warhol. And it just didn't surprise me at all. It felt a lot like my destiny. And From there on, you know, 2 years later, we got the financing and started shooting, and all of it just seemed very natural to me.
Valerie Solanas' Scum Manifesto was her manifesto about women's natural superiority over men and why women needed to basically rid the world of men. Let me read a short excerpt of it. Life in this society being at best an utter bore, and no aspect of society being at all relevant to women, there remains to a civic-minded, responsible, thrill-seeking female only to overthrow the government, eliminate the money system, institute complete automation, and destroy the male sex. Scum will kill all men who are not in the men's auxiliary of scum. Men in the men's auxiliary are those men who are working diligently to eliminate themselves, men who, regardless of their motives, do good, men who are playing ball with scum. Many women will for a while continue to think they dig men, but as they become accustomed to female society and as they become absorbed in their projects, they will eventually come to see the utter uselessness and banality of the male. The few remaining men can exist out their puny days, dropping out on drugs or strutting around in drag, or passively watching the high-powered female in action, fulfilling themselves as spectators, vicarious lovers, or breeding in the cow pasture with the toadies. Or they can go off to the nearest friendly neighborhood suicide center, where they will be quietly, quickly, and painlessly gassed to death. This woman strikes me as, you know, really insane.
Yeah, funny though too. I mean, the thing was is that she is insane, but she was also very funny, and was a provocateur and outrageous. And part of her gift, I think, was pushing the envelope and going to that extreme to sort of, you know, bulldoze through all of it to get to like some like truth.
I want to talk with you about your portrayal of Valerie Solanas. Let's start with the voice. You have a deeper, sometimes ironic, sometimes hectoring voice that you use in the film with a pretty strong New York accent. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you did to develop this sound.
Okay, I will. Jeremiah Newton, he had an audio tape of Valerie from, I believe it might have been 1974, something like that. And he gave it to me, and it was much more extreme than the voice I used in the movie. And I started working with that voice, and Mary Harron said that it was masking my emotions too much. And she said, let the voice go, which I was really afraid about, because I think as an actor, I'm always afraid to go to myself, which is where I'll always end up going, but I'm always afraid to go there. Because it's just, I guess also that fear that maybe I'm not enough, or to not have anything to hide behind. Mm-hmm. It's just much more frightening. You're more vulnerable. So I was like, oh, God, shoot. And so anyways, I was like, okay. And I did agree with Mary, and I was thankful. And I let it go. But I think I had to keep remnants just because I needed that sort of that velocity or that thrust, you know, to help drive her emotions, you know. And so that's what I think that's what I just naturally had to keep. You know, I think it was more like a thrust that she used, like the consonants, you know, and a badgering. She was aggressive. She bulldozed over people. She didn't really care.
Yeah, I like the way you use the word thrust, because you walk as Valerie Solanas with your head jutting forward.
Right, right.
You know, your head's leading your body by several inches.
Because that's like where all the stuff was in her, was her head, too much so. I mean, it was part of her demise, was her head. It was overtime. She had an IQ of 131. She was too much of a thinker, you know, drove her nuts.
Now, on your face, she's very, even when she's saying things that you might find funny or ironic, her facial expression is almost always really serious and often very suspicious.
Right, right.
I mean, she's suspicious of other people.
Paranoid schizophrenic.
Right. Is that how she was diagnosed?
Yeah. If I don't get them first, they'll get me. I mean, constantly, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I like, you know, the beginnings of that, like those little seeds of that paranoia. It was her against the world. It was her against the world.
Tell me some of the other things that went into your portrayal of Solanas.
Right. Mary Harron, the director, had done 7 years of research going back to her childhood. So she had files and files of, you know, points of view, interviews, all sorts of things, which I could not have done without, because Valerie's not mentioned in anything. She's mentioned in four books, basically. She's not even mentioned in the psychology section, because I think she's an interesting psychological study. Mm-hmm. She's very complicated. Anyway,
I think that's what I find most interesting about her, by the way.
Is her psychology?
Yeah, the psychology of somebody who's really smart and really crazy at the same time, and you never know what you're going to get from them.
Yep. One quote that I finally came up with that I think was the anchor for me was clear vision in a crippled psyche.
Right.
And that did it for me. Once I found that, then that held everything for me. Because that's her. Clear vision in a crippled psyche. And then lots of smaller contradictions, you know, underneath that big umbrella. But she's fascinating. I had all that 7 years of research that Mary had done. I had the manifesto, which actually, you know, rereading it, I mean, I must have read it over 100 times and really, really, you know, read it. Turned out it was so revealing. So many different selves were revealed through that manifesto. And I don't even think she was aware of mm-hmm. how much she was revealing. She was so much was unconscious to her. You know, she was unconscious about how much she was owned by her hatred for men, you know? If she had become conscious of it and used it constructively, it could be a whole different ball game, you know? And that's one thing I'm trying to do is to be much more conscious of my stuff so I'm not so owned by it, you know, and consumed by it.
My guest is Lily Taylor, and she's starring in the new film I Shot Andy Warhol. She plays Valerie Solanas, who shot Andy Warhol three times in 1968. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with actress Lily Taylor. She's starring in the new film, I Shot Andy Warhol. I have to tell you, it was really a thrill to see you in this role because it's a really good part and you do it so well. And, I mean, unfortunately, there aren't many movies with really interesting parts for actresses.
Right.
Where you could do a really complicated psychological performance.
Right.
So I just want to say, you know, how exciting it was to watch you. And I wonder if you experienced that as an actress, that it's hard to find stuff you really want to do.
Yeah, it is. But I have found the way. I have found the way, and it has not been easy. I mean, it's been a lot of, you know, hard work. And I mean also in terms of just the way the choices that I've been making, you know, the quieter, you know, slower route. But I've stuck it out, and I've found a niche, and I've found people of like mind. And you know, this past year I did six films, and each role was really great. And even like number one on the call sheet, which is a very rare thing for a female. And I hate to put it in such like a shallow context, but it's like number one on the call sheet. Oh my God!
What does that mean? What does that mean?
That means like that. Usually it's like the man's number one, and the woman's like maybe number four, number three, if she's lucky, number two. You know what I mean? When you get your call sheet, an actor gets a call sheet for the day's work. And each actor's like numbered.
Numbered by what?
Like Lily Taylor, number one, call time 9:30. You know, actor number two. And I don't know why. It's just an easy system, I guess, for them to work out. You know what I mean?
So if you have the bigger part, you're number one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like Mel Gibson's number one all the time.
Right, okay.
You know what I mean?
Got it.
And so, like, I realized, like, I'd never been really number one on a call sheet. I was always like number two, three, or four, whatever. And I was like, wow, I'm starting to be like number one. Granted, the budget's $10, but still, I'm number one. This is great. And you know, it's really to have that opportunity, especially as a woman, because it's just people just aren't really interested in like a woman's experience unless, again, it's like the funds are really low and you don't need to make your money back. You know what I mean? And those are the people that I like working with.
I think most of your movies have been independent films. Not all of them, but most of your bigger roles, I think, have been in independent films.
And because no one won't put up money for a female lead if it's not independent.
It's not like a glamour lead.
Exactly. If it's not whatever that is that would, of course, pull the money in, which we know what those things are, you know. But exactly. So I have to keep going lower and finding, you know, either where the money's totally independent, you know, or autonomous, or where it's really like $20,000 and they're willing to make, you know, not all of it back or wait till it comes back. And I found those people. And so when you say, are you upset with the roles that are out there? Yeah, I'm upset like on a, you know, on like a, you know, as like just a feminist and so on. But as an actor, I've been so lucky. Not even lucky, though. I've done work to seek these people out, too.
How? What do you do?
What do I do? Well, a lot of it's just like, you know, just sending out that feeling that I'm down. I really am down. I'll work really hard. I'll go to any lengths. I'll pick up a cable. I don't care. I'll work for nothing to help tell your story as a director. And if you respect me and tell a good story, you know. And I think by just sending out that feeling through my actions and just through, you know, meeting up with people and so on, it's happened. It has happened. This year is an example of it. Each role this year has been a great role, an interesting role, and a nice female experience, you know, that has more dimension.
How important do you think that a woman's looks are more important than a man's looks in the film
Absolutely.
Industry?
Period. Absolutely. No doubt about it. On every level. When I do press and I have to deal with the photo shoots, I don't say this much if I was a man. Dot, 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 dot. I just don't say that much because, you know, I don't really need to. It's just unspoken. But I have to say, if I was a man, you wouldn't be doing this to me. It's just that simple.
Doing what?
Putting all this glop on me and don't put this glop on me. I don't want makeup. I'm not going to do makeup and don't put lingerie on me. I'm not going to do lingerie. And they always like, it's like, I'm like, do you guys have a problem here? There's like nothing on this rack. I like clothing. Go get me some clothes. Okay? And so it's like, I've put my foot down, and that's the way I'm doing it. You don't have to do it the other way. You just don't. That's what I think.
You know what I think is really funny? Your movie debut is in Mystic Pizza, which also launched the film career of Julia Roberts. And I could hardly think of two actresses who've headed in two completely different directions. She's like, you know, the glamour actress is in the major, you know, the major motion picture releases. And you're becoming like one of the queens of independent cinema and all these really interesting, unusual independent films.
Right. Julia, it's funny, you know, because this has come up a lot, you know, and I think we're very different also in the sense that I feel like Julia almost was destined for who she is. I feel like I'm destined too for what I am, but I feel she's destined to carry this enormous projection. She's not an icon. I mean, she could get there. She's close though. I mean, it's she's almost not human. You know what I mean? It's a lot. She can carry that. I knew when we were doing Mr. Pizza, I knew that she was going to be a star. I just did. And I think she's almost meant to carry that. And it's not really about, like, the work per se or whatever, but it's about, as I say, carrying this projection. I'm not made for that. I can't do that. And I feel like the way I've gone is exactly the way I should go. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, earlier you were saying that when you prepare for a role, the thing that you have to do is also the thing that's most frightening to do, which is to go deep into yourself.
Right.
And tell me how you do that and what you mean by that.
Right. Well, like, let me use an example. I did this movie last year called Things I Never Told You, and I realized I was extremely petrified because she was normal, like really normal. Like it was more like about the situation. Like, it was about a woman who was in a situation, and it was about the feelings that situation triggered. It wasn't really about this specific personality, and I was petrified. And that's when I realized why. It's like, wow, I don't have anything to hide behind. And I realized that I'd had characters that there was something to hide behind, whether it be a neurosis, whether, you know, you got a vampire, that, you know, you got to hide some, you know, there's something to hide behind there, you know, or Valerie, so on and so forth, but not with that character. And that taught me a lot. It taught me a lot. And it taught me that it reaffirmed for me, because I've directed too, and I always like when the actor reveals themselves. That's where it's alive for me. Not where they're covering up with some idea of a character that doesn't really, it's not really so organic, you know? And so, but I forget that or I don't trust it. And so I'm always trying to remember that, remind myself of that. And that experience, the Things I Never Told You, reminded me of that's That's really where it is, and that's what's important. And I just have to remind myself of what I like to see. Acting that interests me is acting that's alive, honest, and usually showing something of that actor, that person.
My guest is Lily Taylor. In the new film, I Shot Andy Warhol, she plays Valerie Solanas, who shot Warhol 3 times in 1968. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actress Lily Taylor. She stars in the new film, I Shot Andy Warhol. Now, I read that your father owned a hardware store.
But yes.
That he was also an unpublished poet.
That is right.
Do you think he was frustrated running a hardware store when he actually drew and wrote?
Completely. Completely. Period. I mean, big time, man. To see that artist thing, you know, not have its expression, it's sad. It's really sad. You know, it's funny because a friend of mine, he loves that film Mac, which I haven't gotten to see yet, and I'm going to see. But there's a line, you hate your job and you hate your life.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend's been mentioning that a lot, that sentence, and I think about that a lot too. You know, you hate your job, you hate your life. And I've used that as a, like, I didn't articulate it, but as a principle, like an unspoken principle, you know. That means a lot to me, for me to love my job.
Do you think you picked up as a child on your father's desire to be an artist and his frustration that he wasn't professionally?
You know, very good point. You know, I think I did. And, you know, maybe I kind of realized, kind of feeling his frustration of thinking maybe I don't want to be that frustrated. So I'm going to do X, Y, and Z to make sure I'm fulfilled, you know, with my spirit, you know?
As opposed to sticking with the safe career option.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. You just made me realize something.
What was high school like for you?
Horrible. I didn't like it at all. I think everyone sort of has their rough time in life, you know? And I guess mine probably won't be middle age because I think I might have had mine, which was high school.
What was terrible about it?
I just didn't know how to do it. I didn't want to be here. I didn't like being alive. I didn't know how to do it. And it was just get me through this. And finally, I broke through it. And now I really, really like being here a lot.
No, was the problem social or academic?
Oh, social. Well, I just started getting depressed and I stopped going to school. I was sleeping a lot. I just hated life. I was one of those just scowly, you know, very depressed, negative, you know, unhappy, Les Miserables kind of person.
It's nice you can laugh about it now.
Thank God, yeah.
Were you in therapy or anything?
Yeah, but I did it because I didn't want to go to school. So I pretended to my parents that I was going insane. And then I was like, shoot, I got into the therapy. I was like, I said I did this just so I could get out of school. I don't really know what to talk about. But I think there was also like an unconscious thing going on too, you know, that like a cry for help on some level, though I don't think I recognized it at the time. And I had done some voiceover work, so I had a little bit of money so I could pay for it.
So what did you tell the therapist?
Well, then I got in there and I said, I don't know what to talk about because I honestly just didn't want to go to school. And I think being a therapist, she knew there was something deeper going on, you know.
Right.
So she was like, oh, I understand. Sure, of course she didn't want to go to school. And she got in, you know, she knew how to play me, you know.
So did she send you back to school?
No. Uh-uh. Nope. We talked for about 7 years. Yeah, and I worked, so I was able to pay for it, and it turned out to be a very great thing. I'm really glad. It was, you know, a rare opportunity, and I was really glad that I had that because it helped. It helped a lot.
Did you ever go back to school?
Oh, no, yeah, I just missed a lot. I missed about a semester each year, just accumulation of, you know, of just having trouble waking up, you know?
Gee.
Yeah.
Now, what made you think about acting?
You know what? I don't know. I always knew I wanted to do it. It never even crossed anybody's mind that I wanted to do anything else. Always that.
Now, did you think of yourself as attractive when you started acting? And did you think that being beautiful was a requisite for having a career?
Okay. I did not think of myself as attractive. In fact, I had one agent who told me to get a nose job, who said I wouldn't make it. Yeah, she said I wouldn't make it if I didn't get a nose job. This was at 17. And I knew also that I was going to have trouble. I was going to have trouble because, you know, I knew it was up, and I thought, well, that's okay, and it's a blessing in disguise, because I think those ingenue roles are boring anyway. I don't want those.
Well, you started your own theater company, didn't you?
Yeah.
Was that in part to kind of avoid all the trappings of Hollywood?
No, it was basically, I was finding that theater, there was a lot of like impediments going on. And what was happening was that plays weren't getting up. It was just for whatever reason. And I realized, like, my friend was writing these plays, and I thought, let's just get these up. You know, let's just do it. That's what we just wanted to get the plays up and perform them and learn and experiment and all that. And that's why we did it.
You must have learned a lot from being in control and not, you know, by being able to make decisions about what you were going to do, as opposed to being at everybody's mercy, which is the position actors are usually in, at everybody else's mercy.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, but that's been something I've worked really hard at, because I had these fears, like, when I was younger, like I was going to get struck into a situation that I didn't like or that wasn't good for me, because I didn't realize how much choice I had in the matter, you know? And when I realize how much choice I have, you know, and also that, like, I volunteered for this, you know, that I'm not drafted, that helps me so much. It's empowering. And I think a lot of, specifically actors, a lot of decisions are based on fear. And it's almost part of the whole, the system is that the actor's told that they don't have, or made to believe that they don't have choice, that they are at everybody's mercy. And that's not true. That's not true. You know, or that you have to do X, Y, and Z in order to get what you want, or play these rules. And I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. I think you've got to follow your heart. That's, for me, that's been the way to go. Because believe me, there was times at 3 a.m. when I was, you know, doubting very much, like, maybe I really am, you know, not doing the right thing. Maybe I'm really going to mess myself up by making these choices. And that's what I've learned this year, is that my heart did not lead me astray, that it's turned out to be, my heart hasn't let me down.
What were the choices that kept you awake at night?
Well, in a lot of general ways, it was like after making, like, let's say 15 choices, and the accumulation of all those choices and living with them, all of a sudden, you know, 3 a.m, you know, while I'm doing my, you know, let's say little independent film, or little crazy theater piece, and, you know, and let's say I don't get the independent film that I want, you know, that's when I would, you know, question what was going on, because it's when I realized that I was having trouble getting independent films is when I kind of started to worry too. And then I realized they play by the same game, but in a much, you know, less sophisticated, more little bit, better way than Hollywood, but it's the same game. It's the same name game. It's the same money game, just on lesser level, I guess. And that's when I realized, oh no, even I can't get accepted by them. Oh no. Yeah.
So what changed?
What changed? Well, it still really hasn't that much. I mean, I'm not getting offers still. It's still hard for me to get a job in certain ways. And then in other ways, I know that I just know that I'm going to continue to find people that like me, and I'm going to keep liking people, because that's how it's been, and it will continue to be so. And that's okay, and I understand who I am. I understand that I'm complicated and that I'm not, you know, usually, normally good-looking or whatever, all that stuff, you know? And so it's going to take someone who's willing to take a risk, or, you know, so on and so forth, you know, to go with me, and I know those people are out there.
Lily Taylor, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Lily Taylor stars in the new film I Shot Andy Warhol. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurak directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Here's room 546. It's enough to make you sick. Bridget's all wrapped up in foil. You wonder if she can uncoil. Here they come now. See them run now. Here they come now. Chelsea Girls.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.